I'm Erica Ensign.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And we welcome you back to the saga of rereading epics, in which we are rereading, reconsidering, and refeeling, oh, the feels, Julian May's Saga of Pliocene Exile and Galactic Milieu series. And for this episode, we have reread the second book of the Saga of Pliocene Exile, The Golden Torque. And who doggy do I have feelings about this book? How are you feeling?
Oh, I have a lot to process. There were parts of the book where I literally sat up and went, oh no, that wouldn't fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like I thought that I remembered it better than I actually did, because I kept coming upon things and being like, oh,
yeah,
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's The big overwhelming feeling I have with this book is it shows how well constructed the series as a whole is, because you see her moving more bricks into place.
Yes.
And more of her themes become readily apparent. And another thing that I've had to confront, though, is that this book was, in fact, written, in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and some of the attitudes of that time are pretty evident.
Ooh, yeah.
And I had a hard time with that. So, mm-hmm. I have feelings to process there.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. I did too. And I found that somehow it got a little easier for me as the book went on. I don't know if it was just like Stockholm syndrome. Like I was marinating in it long enough that I was just sort of coming to terms with the fact that, yes, this is when this book was written. This is the world that this book takes place in. Or if it got better, I'm not sure. I'm suspecting it was the former.
I think that's it. Also, as you go on and you see the themes that she's setting up, it was compartmentalizing, because I was like, okay, I want to see where she's taking her big old Catholic essentialism theme. And I want to see why she's so heavily invested in using Greek pantheon imagery whenever she talks about the Tanu. And so I chose to follow that path of intellectual curiosity, while at the back of my head, I still had things going, oh, this is a terrible subplot. This was terrible what they did with this character. I don't understand any of those choices. Mm-hmm. So compartmentalizing, it's what's for dinner.
It totally is. All right. Well, this book, just like the first one, is divided into three parts. But the first book had a very different sort of feel to each part. It was really very well defined. Whereas this is, it's three parts, but there was it's kind of arbitrary a little bit.
It where just she flows, decides to, this is where Act One ends. Oh,
yeah,
okay, sure.
Sort of. It's just, I think she just liked, my guess is she liked the idea that she was splitting it up into two parts and wanted to give these nice fancy names to each of the parts. And since she did in the first book, she decided to continue doing it. Sure, that's fine. But but I think this time we'll take it through the plot a little bit more, just, beat by beat, rather than focusing on it section by section. But before we dive into that, did you happen to read the recap of the first book?
I did, just because I wanted to see where they wanted to direct our attention.
Yeah, I found that interesting. But the thing that I found even more interesting was how blatantly she spells out some of the stuff that I thought was really subtext in the first book, and totally makes it text in the little recap intro part. So, like, for example, there's the section where she's talking about Amory and Felice, and she flat out says, Amory felt herself strongly attracted by Felice's violent behavior, which seemed to reflect some of the dark shadows within her own conventional spirituality. And I guess that is what I sort of took out of the first book, but I hadn't really processed it to that degree of just like in your facedness. So I was a little bit surprised to hear the author going, yeah, that's exactly what was going on behind Amory's eyes when she's dealing with this, because it totally could have been taken in several other ways. It was a pretty, like, the conversation as they had it in the first book was not that obvious about it. And I was a little disappointed, I think, that she just kind of just tossed it out there, like splatting paint down on the
I think it serves a shorthand in this book, because it serves a shorthand to explain why some characters, and we'll get to this, so I'm trying not to be a spoiler, it's going to explain why some characters go out of their way to help Felice at the end of the book. Is it's going to suggest that they're doing it sort of as a subconscious, we like Emery, and so this is what Emery would want us to do. And in order to understand why Felice matters so much to Emery, they spell it out in that way.
Yeah, the other thing that I noticed too was, actually there's a couple other ones, talking about Suki and Stein's marriage, and how dangerous it was and how well hidden it was. I did not get that from the first book. Like, I knew that it was forbidden, you know, humans are not supposed to have babies or whatever. I didn't really realize that actual marriage was a death, like that was a death sentence. And they never said, and she never said anything in the first book about, like, at least that I recalled, about how deeply that was being buried by them and other people trying to, like, help keep their psychic shields up.
This is her setting, like, this, the whole synopsis of the first book is basically her going, this is what I want you to pay attention to in the second book. So when I do introduce these themes, you already have some dread, some foreboding, some emotional investment, because I get the sense that she's trying to speed up the action. This book is a lot more zippy.
True. Very true.
Than the first one, and I think it's because the author is like, I have a lot of story to get through, so
we gotta get rolling. But I think I found it a little bit disappointing. Specifically, the last one that I noticed was where she talks about how Aiken Drum had started burning through his control circuits and that his powers were, quote, fully oriented toward aggression. That's not necessarily what my read was on the first book, and it's still really kind of not my read on the second book. So I didn't really like how she was like planting the seeds that, you know, okay, fine, you're the author, you get to decide how you feel about it, but if you don't put that on the page in the text, I don't feel like it's necessarily a, you know, it's a valid reading, but I didn't like it being foisted upon me before I even got into this book.
I also disagree with the read that it's aggressive, because if you take a look at him in the first book, the challenge is that he's somebody who has tremendous capacity for leadership. But, yeah, I mean, you don't include that. In the first book, you don't include the anecdote about him convincing everybody to explode a whale. Unless it's to point out that people will go along with what Aiken Drum does. And then you also see he is the force that binds together Group Green. He interacts with everybody. He figures out really quickly where everybody's levers are and pulls and pushes them in the name of what he's decided needs to happen, which is we need to have a solid group identity so we can go through together because we're each other's best chances for survival. Those are leadership skills. And in the first book, the impression I get of that character is he is somebody who has tremendous leadership potential. He just lacks moral development to go along with it. And so I felt what she was signaling was Aiken's story is going to be, does he develop a conscience or does he not? Like, he's always been powerful. It's just a question of where that power goes. And in a way, Felice, who's also profoundly antisocial, is supposed to have a parallel story. But it's interesting to me that both Aiken and Felice are kind of treated like monsters when only one of them has gone out of their way to harm people.
Yeah, and I mean, and she does touch on the leadership aspect of it, definitely, when she's talking about Aiken, because she says that he might, quote, seek to dominate not only the exotic races of the Pliocene Earth, but humanity as well. And that one totally checks out. Like, story 100% checks out. Like, if that made sense at the beginning, it certainly was clear that that was where he was headed by the end of the book. But yeah, there were a number of bits and pieces, and I don't always read the sort of recap sections of books, especially if I've just fairly recently read the first part. But this time I decided I would, just to sort of see, like you said, where is she shining the spotlight? And, you know, what am I taking from that? And I'm like, ugh. I wasn't happy with it, frankly.
Well, this sounds, I learned that trick from Anne McCaffrey because I checked out all of her books from the library, and you know, when I was a little nerd reader, I wasn't quite so adamant about reading them in order. And I think I had read, like, Dragon Song and Dragon Singer, which are the YA versions of, oh, you know, this woman impresses fire lizards and she spends some brief time in a weir. and then goes off to have music adventures. And then my mom found the white dragon at the library and brought that back to me. So I actually read that before I read the two preceding books in the original.
Interesting.
And so, of course, I read the prologue, which catches you up on to here. Here's how Jaxum comes to impress, and here's the political situation. And she had all of these characterizations of people that I'm like, oh, okay, obviously, you know, Kailara, the other queen rider, is a monster, and obviously the old timers are all terrible, blah, blah, blah. And then I went back and read books one and two, and I was like, wait, no, that's not what happened at all. And so even as a, you know, so I thought, okay, why did she write them that way? And then I realized, oh, it's to put you in the headspace of what, of how you're supposed to sympathize with the characters in the current book. So the author is not beholden to, like, objectively recapping their past stories. They're just beholden to making sure you're in a space to receive the story they want as they want you to receive it in the present. And so it's been really, really useful for almost anything I do ever is I always go and I read the, you know, you read the synopsis of anything that, that they want you to read and go, all right, this is where they're, this is where they want your attention to go. So, ask why.
Yeah. Yeah. That totally makes sense. Yeah. Excellent point. All right. Well, so this book starts out with, time travels backwards in a time travel book a little bit from where we ended the previous book, because now we're getting to see what happened to the other half of Group Green. They have traveled south instead of north to get to the capital. And, you know, so they arrive. And one of the first things that happens in the beginning of this book is Brian, our anthropologist, learns about the breeding plan, basically, and how humans are just used as brood mares, and how the king gets to be, you know, he's got first dibs, basically.
Yeah, Droita Senior. I actually, so do we want to just talk about like Brian's whole plotline period?
Yeah, let's go through this. And yeah, it actually makes a lot more sense than I had remembered.
Yeah, so, no, because when I read this the first time in my teens, it was like, oh, Brian, he perishes for love of mercy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand it as a teenager. It seemed really weird and monstrous to me. And I went back this time and read it. And I thought, there are literally two handful of characters who are like, Brian, 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 watch what you're doing, Brian. Brian, are you sure this is a good idea, Brian? Like, he keeps getting warned by literally everybody that his current path is not a good one. And he just ignores all warnings. And then when he meets up with Mercy, I actually highlighted this part because it was so noticeable for me, is when he meets up with her, he pours champagne to Mercy, and the words that Mercy spoke had no meaning and they brought no pain. She was here with him, and so nothing else mattered. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, that's that is one of the darkest characterizations. It's Brian who always just ignores what he doesn't want to hear and doesn't want to believe and doesn't want to see. And so he ignores the fact that he doesn't know or understand Mercy at all. And then he ignores the fact that the fact-finding report he's been asked to put together is going to be used as a highly political tool and will ultimately turn out to be lethal to him. Like, literally decides that doesn't matter because it doesn't fit in with his fantasy of himself. Mm-hmm. And he goes to his death just completely oblivious. He never has a moment of clarity. He just falls deeper and deeper and deeper into this incredibly self-indulgent daydream and gets used by other people.
I disagree with that a little bit. I think he does have clarity. I think he knows, like, he actually says it at some point, or he thinks it to himself, that he knows that that he is dying of her, I believe is how he puts it. But he just doesn't care. So I feel like he's clear. He just is so leaning into it. And I had sort of written down that same passage that you did, like that her words have no meaning. And the reason that I am more okay with this time through is a plot point that I just never picked up on before, or at least didn't remember. And that is the fact that when Mercy gets to the exile. You know, they do the testing and stuff on her brain, and they find she has amazing creative metapsychic powers, very, very in tune with the Tanu. And they apparently, and I mean, it could be an unreliable narrator here, but she says that they tested her germplasm and discovered that it was more Tanu than human. So my reading now, this time through, is that one of the reasons probably that Brian just fell in love with her so hardcore in the first place was because she had all of this like latent Tanu metapsychic abilities.
She's like a throwback.
Yeah. And that's why it's killing him, because, you know, getting it on with any other human woman in a golden torque would probably be a lot of fun, but not terribly detrimental. But because she is practically a Tanu, that that he is experiencing sort of the same thing that poor Ramo, the woodcutter, experienced. And he even mentions that, Ramo does, at the end when they're stuck in the Great Retort.
Is that he's basically being
he's been
death.
Through the same thing. Yep.
Yeah, no, because there's Nodon Battlemaster mentions that he had Greg Donnett do a genetic assay, and there's the quote where he says, "Mercy Rosmar's plasm is almost identical to our own. Mm-hmm. She has more of our genes than she has of human." And so what we establish in this book is that Mercy has essentially forsaken her humanity, and she's thrilled about that. Mm-hmm. And let's see, she mentions, I can't remember if it's this, I don't have it highlighted, but there's a line that sticks out. Oh, it's in this book where she laughs and she says, "We Tanu love dogs."
Yes.
And that just shows that how completely she's turned her back on her old life and her humanity. Mm-hmm. And that to her, Brian is just a useful tool. Like his love for her is based in his own fantasy. And there may be the suggestion that he was doomed because even before she got the torque, she was bewitching in a way that Tanu women were going to be more bewitching than humans. So maybe Bran was just doomed from the minute he had sex with her in the first book. But the whole plot line is just Bran merrily tripping to his doom over the report that he writes, and which she takes.
yes.
And, you know, at the behest of her husband. And what struck me about the plot line this time through is what a canny political actor Mercy is, like from the word go. You know, and
I mean, it all does make sense because, you know, she her past life where she was not happy on, you know, Milieu Earth, but she was in charge of organizing an awful lot of things. So, you know, she gets back there and she's been miserable all this time. And while, yes, I mean, she's definitely made out to be a bit of a villain in this book, but at the same time, like,
I don't think the author's fair to her.
Yeah, because I feel like, look at it from her perspective, she has finally literally found everything that she's ever wanted, and she's happy, and she's totally honest. Like, she's never lies to Brian, like, at all. So I feel like, yeah, she's made out to be a villain, but at least the book has made it clear what her reasons are. And
I feel like it's so unfair to her because the reason she was so unhappy in the Milieu era Earth is because she's literally a species outside her culture.
Yep.
Like, she is the only, because they never mention any other people who are nominally human coming back through the gate and being tested and having the same germ plasm as the Tanus. Like, she's effectively a genetic throwback to the breeding program. Mm-hmm. We don't know how, it's never explained, but she's a genetic throwback. She's fundamentally a different species. So she fundamentally can't connect on a cultural or emotional or physical level. And she's trapped. She's a person out of time who's trapped. And she finally gets to go back to the time and the culture and the species where she truly belongs. She's satisfied and she's fulfilled. But the way she's written, it's that this somehow makes her evil. Or it somehow makes her amoral by, like, the rules of the universe that Julian May is setting up. Because I think it's notable here that one of the big points of conflict through this volume is that Brian and one of the king's sons,
Ogmal,
by a human woman, are commissioned to write a report on the impact of the time travelers on Tanu culture. And what they essentially conclude is that the Tanu culture, which is highly conservative, after all, this is a reactionary group of conservatives who left their galaxy because they were told to maybe not go around being colonizing killers anymore. They come back and they find out that their highly reactive, highly conservative culture is in fact under threat from hybrid vigor and hybrid culture and immigration.
Yep.
And so their big thing is we have to shut down this report because it can't get out.
Mm-hmm. And even at the end, Brian is he still has enough of his faculties about him to try to point out that it's too late. You can't unring this bell. You know, even if you kill all, you know, like even if you kill all of the humans and all of the half-breeds, like you're still your society has still been changed inexorably. So there's nothing you can do. But as he mentions, Nadan does a very nice job of sort of twisting the details and making it serve his own narrative, his own purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I believe it's Nadan who actually says, and I highlighted this because it has uncanny resonance right now, as Nadan tells the rest of his council, we've become lax and decadent as we adopted first their domesticated animals as our battle mounts, then their very selves. Yes, we adopted humanity. They fight our battles. They grow our food. They operate our mines and factories. They administer our commerce. They infiltrate our sacred guilds. They mingle their very blood and genes with our own. And we are faced with the ultimate humiliation. And we have brought it on ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I read this and I thought, holy carp. Wow. Some rhetoric is timeless. Because again, this book was written late 70s, published in the early 80s. And I could easily imagine this being somebody's tweet storm.
Yeah, right. Oh my God.
So you have, again, a conservative culture that relies really heavily on exploiting labor, and they're actually upset that what this has done instead is this has altered their culture to a point of unhealthy, what they perceive as unhealthy, interdependency. They're really angry about it. And this sets up this sets up all manner of machinations.
Yeah, the flip side of that, which I had not really remembered, like I kind of remembered that part of it. I had not remembered that there was sort of a peace-loving faction of the Tanu who were kind of sick of this, you know, bloodthirsty hunt that they would do and wanted to just, you know, can't we all just get along? Like they wanted humans and half-breeds and Tanu to just be chill with each other and continue to, you know, interbreed and use the technology that humanity has brought along. And I had totally forgotten that there were these, you know, sort of hidden figures in the midst of all of the Tanu that were working toward that end. And I had absolutely forgotten that Mavar Kingmaker, who immediately at the beginning of the book takes Aiken under her wing, steps up for him. And I had forgotten that she was one of them. So she's really working behind the scenes to try to put Aiken Drum on the throne because he is a human who has all of the powers and such that are required to actually rule over a society like this. And who will then encourage the sort of blissful, somewhat peaceful era, which is, again, why I have trouble with Julian May referring to his powers being fully oriented toward aggression, because mm-hmm. I just totally didn't get that. But I liked how, so she's you know, taken him in. They've had a lot of sex. And she's helping him develop his powers. He's becoming operant. He doesn't need his torque anymore. And I like very much that one of her tests for him was when he was trying
to... Is he supposed to kill his friends?
Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. the smart tactical thing to do is to kill Stein and Suki because they know information about you that if it gets out, it's going to harm you. And the fact... And, like, at that point... I didn't know which way he was going to go either.
I know. I had forgotten about that scene, believe mm-hmm. it or not.
Yeah.
And when I read that, I was on tenterhooks, animal. And he chooses. And I was like, oh my God, he's growing a conscience. This is amazing. This is the story progressing.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's definitely a pretty narrowly focused conscience because, you know, those are the only two that he feels that strongly about. But, you know, but that's still two people that he is willing to keep alive. I mean, when it comes down to it, like when Claude and Madame are off on their goal of trying to close the time gate. He like he definitely wants to kill them because he needs to stop them, but he's telling himself that he's going to do it cleanly and mercifully, rather than his cohort Gomnol wants him to bring them back and have them boil alive, basically, in the great offering during the grand combat. So there are a couple different moments where he's got like these sort of different layers and different shades of conscience, and I appreciate that was something that was brought to the fore in this book.
He's such a compelling character. I mean, he pops off the screen. That said, the thing that takes me out of the story every time I stumble across it is when he's described as having a gollywog grin.
Yes. Let's talk
every
about
time.
That.
Mm-hmm. Every time. Because I actually Googled to see, is there some second... for readers who may not know, gollywog is a racial slur.
Yeah, well, it's...
It was used more heavily in the UK, as I understand it, and that's where the derivative slandered term of and I'm really sorry, wog comes from, is gollywog.
Yeah, it comes from a character in a book, which is a doll, and it is a doll that is made out of, I assume, black cloth with just kind of fuzzy hair. So, yeah. Like,
and then,
you know,
like, a big white and red grin.
Yep.
So it's basically blackface.
It's very much, very much.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's uncomfortable. And it should be make uncomfortable. And so to have Aiken's grin described as a gollywog grin, I thought, okay, maybe she has a really vivid visual image in her mind. But
he's never described as like a character of color at all. Like almost nobody is.
He comes from a Scottish planet where he was effectively bred from donated germplasm.
Yep.
So he's bred to be Scottish down to the DNA. Mm-hmm. And if they could have found, if May could have found a different way to describe the grin, I wouldn't be so startled by it every time I see it.
Yeah. And it was in there at least 10 times. Like I was kind of like low key keeping count.
And I keep thinking, if I, who am admittedly just like a white woman living in the Bay Area, get that startled by it, what is it like if you are a non-white reader? And
you recognize that word.
Yeah, and you're like, oh.
Because I certainly didn't know what it meant when I was when I was younger. I somehow I thought it had something to do with a doll, which turns out it was right. I didn't realize the awful connotations that are associated with that doll. And it made me sort of start questioning everything, because then I started thinking, okay, how many people of color do we actually have in these books? And the only person that I could think of who is that I remembered explicitly being described as a person of color is, I believe it was one of the fellows who captained the riverboat that gets them down through the
Glissade. This is this comes up later. In later books, there is a woman who is explicitly described as a black woman.
Okay, so
so she pops up in books 3 and 4.
But yeah, I just felt like the one person that I could think of was, I think, the guy that they basically capture and torture so that they can get, and he's in a position of servitude. It kind of started to disturb me a little bit.
So that was jarring. But what I love about Aiken, but to get back to Aiken Drum, when I wasn't being like, what I really love is how he ends the book effectively having identified Mercy as a very useful player and choosing to rescue her in a rather dramatic fashion and ally himself with her.
Or ally herself with him, because he
rescues her, so he creates a relationship of indebtedness.
Mm-hmm. He's the only one who has much left in the way of
mental power.
So he cleans her off and dries her off and changes her dress from red and gold, which was were Nadan's colors, to black and gold, which are his colors.
And
she kind of immediately, I'm not going to say full on goes for it, but she definitely changes her tune as soon as that happens. And she's just like, what are you thinking?
Mercy has some finely honed survival skills. I mean, this is, again, I think, and this is a thing where I like these books tremendously. And I like the pacing. I like the plots. I like the themes that Julian May is developing. But I really feel like the way she's writing Mercy does that character no favors. Because again, you have somebody who's effectively an alien, who's finally found her own culture, and to imply that Mercy is just somebody who there's the question: is she just somebody who uses and abuses human beings, or is she in fact a fairly canny political strategist who recognizes when she's on the downswing and is like, okay, this is who I have to cleave to jockey in this new world order. I feel like she gets a bad rap.
Yep.
Which is admittedly not something I felt the first time I read this series. Like the first time I read this series, through the back three books, I'm like, why are so many characters tying themselves in knots over her? and I felt that way about Elizabeth too. And this time, the way I'm reading it is, why aren't we giving Mercy more credit for surviving as long as she has?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And being as successful as she is.
Yes, because we get introduced to the council, and they're back and forth jockeying, and it's like Tudor England with the court intrigues, and Mercy very successfully floats above it.
Yep.
Because we also get a full sense of Kulaket here.
Yes.
One of our big bads, and he's just genuinely awful.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, at least we have somebody who is very clearly, just clearly cut, a bad guy. Like, you know, because you've got Mercy and Nadan who are, they are fighting for the things that they believe in. So, but they're still sort of framed as the adversaries, so to speak.
They're like lawful evil, but this guy is just pure.
pure chaos. Well, he may be lawful evil too, actually, come to think of it. But it's just evil in an icky way.
Especially... like because he takes a lot of pleasure in inflicting pain.
Yes.
And like that is his jam. Is he's like, ooh, I just really love torturing people. That's what does it for me. And goes from there. We have a couple basic through lines in this book. The first one is Aiken quickly gets the lay of the land, as it were, in several sentences. And gets positioned to become a major player in Tanu politics. We get a sense of the internecine Tanu battles because there is, like you said, the peace faction. Nansuval's host, which is the number of children she's had, are all jockeying for power against dear old dad. And that's Nodon Battlemaster and Kulaket who are heading that up. And so they have their own little palace intrigues going on. And then thrown into this is Elizabeth, who you remember has been pushed to full operancy, is incredibly unhappy about that.
Yep.
And is even more incredibly unhappy to discover that she's going to be conscripted into the king's breeding program. Mm-hmm. So that brings us to like one of the second through lines, which is, which I think at some point I was like, Julian May's Catholic is showing. I wrote it several points. Because she's super unhappy about this. We discover that somebody went through the gates who was actually able to reverse the sterilization procedure, and that is why you have human women who are referred to as breeding stock and are actually put into like mental comas to continue to be available to breed to the Tanu men until their bodies give out from overuse. Mm-hmm. And then you have... the part of the book that genuinely appalled me, and I had to like put it down and remember that reading this in 2019 was very different than writing it in, say, 1980 or what have you. But was this the part that really threw you too? When you meet Tasha Bybar, the gynecologist.
That is it. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult, it starts out difficult in one way because you have, you have Suki who is in love with Stein and, you know, just wants to be married to him and nobody else. And we've gotten this little tidbit of hope that she's going to maybe be able to sidestep all of this, and Aiken's going to have enough power to save her and Stein, and they're going to be able to, you know, run off and have babies and live happily ever after. So you got that little tantalizing bit of hope, and then timing strikes, and she has to go and visit Tasha Bybar, who is the gynecologist who has figured out how to reverse this
sterilization procedure.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so she's got to do that, and she's panicking, and that just that idea of forced unsterilization makes mm-hmm. me feel very, very uncomfortable on just like, you know, one purely like just visceral level. Mm-hmm. And then we meet Tasha.
And it's just such a grotesquerie.
Yes.
Because even before you meet her, the way she's described by the characters is so cruel and dismissive. It's biological essentialism. Because mm-hmm. at one point, one of the lines that Dedra says is, "Within that voluptuous female form with the enhanced secondaries and the estrogen implants, there beats the heart of a true XY." And I read that and I thought, that's hate speech.
It is.
Because what you're doing is you're basically arguing that biology is destiny, mm-hmm. which is horrifying. And then she talks extremely dismissively about assistive reproductive technology.
She talks about a frustrated motherhood, mm-hmm. and how like she because Tasha can't have babies, she's kind of gone insane. And then when she says, "No one in our galactic milieu or anywhere else has ever made a true mother out of a male,"
and I thought to myself,
almost threw the book across the room.
I was just like, there are actually people who have written very movingly about how they've had to navigate the really tricky path between what their body is capable of doing versus the gender that they live and identify as. And I thought, wow, this is horrible in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And then you meet her and she's a freak show.
Yeah. Like, it's not just like... the one tiny thing that I will give this book is the fact that to some extent, like it's not seen as a, like, they're not gasping over the fact that she's trans. So that makes me think that there are possibly, and maybe this is just me reading into it with my 2019 brain, that there are plenty of trans people in the future. And that's like the fact that she's trans in and of itself in the milieu is not an issue. But then what Julian May does with her, the one and only representative character that we get for anybody who is trans, is just
awful.
Yeah. You know,
she's a sideshow freak.
Yes.
And she's giggling and she's, because I thought, okay, it would be one thing. I actually disagree about the milieu being okay with trans people. Mm. Because again, this goes back to May's views on biological essentialism, where she effectively argues that people are the sum total of the brain they were born with. And with the rhetoric that she's got going on here and the arguments that she makes for, creative people having one type of personality trait and coercion types having another and I think her conception of the milieu would be, we have people who can fix your brain so that you feel the gender that you were assigned at birth. Like, I'm pretty sure that's the direction she would go. Because one of the themes that begins to get embroidered in this book is comes out very strongly against reproductive coercion. But she also comes out pretty strongly against reproductive technology, because the geneticists in the book are depicted as fairly monstrous and unhinged and deeply disrespectful of human life. And when she's writing passages about like Greg Donnett and the experimentation that he does, or the things that Tasha Bybar does because of her unnatural desire to be a mother and the fact that biology refuses to cooperate, I was like, oh, that's a lot of Catholic philosophy around reproduction that's coming to the fore there. Like, she really seems to have a difficult time countenancing the idea that it's okay to bring life into a world if there's a petri dish involved. And without spoiling future books, this is a theme that she goes on to completely embellish and then finally, like, unapologetically sign, seal, and deliver by book number 4. And when we get to that book, we get there too. But yeah, she brings out, so if it, it when I saw when I read this, I was like, oh, Tasha Bybar. So I thought, oh, you're going to get somebody who has like her white coat and is all, and you know, and is brisk and competent and all business. And instead you get somebody who has pierced her body and festooned it with lots of bells and does naked burlesqueries and then like happens to reconnect a few fallopian tubes while she's off dancing and giggling and undulating in obscene parody of sexual congress. And I thought, wow, this is a writer who really wants you to be revolted by literally everything here. Yep. Like not just the act of forcibly restoring a woman's fertility so it can be co-opted by the state, which is gross and awful and horrifying unto itself. But she wants you to imply that the person who does that kind of violation is in themselves a walking violation of the natural order. And that's where I just kind of like had to nope out for a while.
Mm-hmm. And then the fact that her death, you know, Stein finds out what has happened. She happens to be in the room and he just can't contain his rage and he kills her. And the fact that not only is she killed by being penetrated by his sword, and the fact that nobody really seems to care that much about it. Like even the Tanu who, you know, they're sad because they've lost her skills, but mm-hmm. and you know, they're a little bit sad, like, oh, this, you know, this poor crazy woman is now gone. Oh, that's too bad. But it's really just, it kind of falls with a thud compared to some of the other deaths that we've seen in this story. So it was kind of a double whammy there.
And like you said, I'm reading this with 2019 brain.
Because
again, the fact that I didn't even remember this when I read it in 1990 should tell you a whole lot about just the ambient regard we had for things like reproductive coercion and differently and people with fluid gender identities and things like that. Like that part didn't register with me so much in this book.
It did for me. I didn't remember it because I'd kind of blocked it out, because as soon as like we started creeping up on this like part, I was just like, like even before we got to the scene with Tasha, like it suddenly twigged for me. I was like, oh my God, she's trans and it's terrible. And then I got to this, they got to the paragraph and that story, part of the story. Sure enough, it was terrible. Mm-hmm. And so it was like the part that affected me, I think, the most deeply over the course of all of the books was just the Tanu breeding program and forcing women to give birth against their will. But this was a very close second. I think it was more of just, you know, the malaise of like the entirety of the breeding program just sort of sunk into me. And I kind of vaguely remembered that. But this was more like a punch to the gut in terms of how it emotionally affected me.
Yeah. Well, it's there was a... you know, when Brian's interviewing people at the beginning of the book and realizing the scope of the Tanu breeding program, the way somebody describes it is a woman can be put on oblivion hold and used as broodstock until she breaks down. And the note I have there is, notice the distancing language, because what they've done is they dehumanize the woman and then they refer to she breaks down. And that means they don't have to admit that what they've effectively done is violated her unto the point of death. Mm-hmm. Like they just imply that it was a breakdown in mechanics. It's a tool. The tool broke. It can't be used anymore. As opposed to, you know, deliberately doing something that awful to another human being. And I found that notable then, because, you know, May is not dumb, and May is pointing out to you that how we talk about things will color how people perceive them. And even humans have gotten to a point where they regard women as just broodstock, which is like a resource to be allocated, as opposed to people who maybe shouldn't have to be, you know, turned into coerced breedstock. So we have that. And then another part of the book, of course, centers on Felice. Mm-hmm. And, I'm also more uncomfortable with how Felice gets over the course of the books. I get more uncomfortable with how Felice gets treated, because it seems like the relation to her fixation on Amory and the way she's treated, and the fact that she clearly fixates on Felice in like an amorous and sexual way, and gets tortured for her trouble by a man. Like, it seems to me like there's a whole lot of really problematic messages there for non-straight women.
Yeah, very true. And I had somehow remembered Felice being more monstrous, and I think that it comes from the end of this book, the fact that she really does follow through with her promise to take them all out, so to speak. But throughout this book, like up until the point that she is captured and taken by Kulliket, she's not monstrous. She's definitely, you know,
she's manipulative.
She's manipulative, and she seems to be psychically damaged in some way, and is not maybe as mentally healthy as she could be. But she is, she's making good choices, I feel like, and she's doing the right thing. She's trying to save her fellow humans, and maybe it is all based on the idea that she wants to get revenge for this place not being what she wanted it to be. But it's a good cause, and she's working toward it, and she's working with other people. She's, you know, she very easily could have just gone her own way and sort of mind blasted a whole bunch of people to get what she wanted. And she doesn't do that. She manages to rein herself in. And I just that makes it hurt me even more, knowing basically what was destroyed when Kulliket tortures her so much. Yeah, sure, it brings her to operancy. It makes her able to do all this stuff without a torque. But I feel like she was on the path toward developing into a, you know, somewhat mentally healthy person who could have gone on to be a real force for change and for good in this world. And that is not what we end up getting.
No, it's a parallel to... So there's Felice's story is meant to parallel to others, I think, because... It parallels Aiken Drum, because again, they're both fairly sociopathic when you start the book, except that we see that Aiken begins to develop a conscience and begins to direct his leadership capabilities in a big picture sort of way. Because, you know, he ends the book with, well, here's to me. And with Felice, you see her exercising those leadership capabilities to a point, and then like, she's tortured to the point of insanity. So you see that she and Aiken have their experiences with the Tanu and get pushed in two very different directions as a result of those experiences, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing with her and Kulliket is also a parallel to another one of the plots in this book, which is between Elizabeth and the ship spouse, where the Breed's ship spouse is like, please raise me to operancy because it's the only way I can help my people. And Elizabeth is like, it's going to be super painful and it's going to require a lot of sacrifice. You're going to have to be able to willingly embrace the suffering in order to break through and become a bigger person. And Breed is like, I'll do it. You know, and there's actually some religious commentary that goes on when, you know, Elizabeth notes that religious groups have discovered that pain actually works as a tool for mental engagement. And so you can't be pushed to operancy without being willing to, without the person who pushes you being willing to assume a tremendous amount of self-sacrificing pain. And so Elizabeth pushes Breed to operancy. She assumes that pain. It's an act of sacrifice that gets there. Breed understands it. The Funhouse Mirror version of that is Kulliket pushing Felice to operancy. Mm-hmm. And there's the pain, you know, as necessary for her growth. But the key is that he takes pleasure in inflicting the pain, whereas Elizabeth is like, well, I'm going to be gratified by suffering for someone else's sake. Like, Kulliket completely inverts that relationship, where Felice assumes all of the pain necessary for the growth, and he takes a tremendous amount of pleasure in it. So it's like this fun house mirror version, and this is Felice in a nutshell. This poor character is a fun house mirror version of what Aiken gets when he's embraced by Maevar Kingmaker, and pushed to become better than he was. And she's a fun house mirror version of being pushed into operancy, because the person who does it doesn't suffer with her and help her expand her mind. Instead, he takes a lot of pleasure in making her suffer. And the fact that she gets pushed into operancy, like, is nowhere near the end goal. It's just something that happens. Much to the Tanu's eternal regret. So it was interesting to me that there's that idea of suffering for salvation that gets introduced here, with Elizabeth and Breed ship spouse, and the suffering, which doesn't bring salvation, because it wasn't suffering for the right reasons, which gets introduced with Felice and Kulliket. And I also thought it was really interesting that in addition to the Catholic the Catholic themes that are beginning to emerge, she uses a lot of talk about Greek gods and goddesses. Mm-hmm. Like the ten who are consistently referred to that way. Like Nansouval is referred to as Juno-esque. And,
yeah, Nadon is Apollo.
Oh, yeah. No, constantly mm-hmm. referred to as Apollo. And when Mercy has her picnic with Brian, she refers to the golden apples of the Hesperides. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of Greek pantheon imagery. And I think that that's supposed to code as a corrupt civilization. Hmm. Like, if you're certainly writing from a perspective that's sympathetic to tenets of Judeo-Christianity, then you're going to be like, ah, the Greek gods, terrible, terrible. Oh, my God. mm-hmm. And so I thought it was really notable that the Tenu always get referred to this way. And you don't see any parallels or analogs when you refer to the Fervilleg, not in the last book, not in this one. And Greek mythology certainly had a number of horrifying and divine monsters that you could have referenced, that she could have referenced, but she chooses not to. So, you know, I can't help but think that she's deliberately contrasting two types of belief systems, one of which was overtly pantheistic and incorporated pleasure as a key tenet of the divine rights, and the other one, which is like, oh, suffering is fantastic for you, it makes you better.
Yeah, I had real mixed feelings about that, because I mean, sure, that's the basis for what you have decided your metapsychic abilities and stuff are here, but just the idea that pain is the only way to achieve something makes me uncomfortable just as a human being. I don't like that idea.
Yeah, no, it's hard. And if we continue to slog through after the Pleistocene epic, there's like another five books where the Catholicism subtext becomes explicitly text. And
see, and these are things that I'm looking forward to you pointing out to me, because not being Catholic, not even being Christian, like none of that stuff registers to me. I mean, I read the Chronicles of Narnia a billion times before I had any idea that there was any kind of Christianity wound up in there. So,
oh my gosh,
yeah,
oh wow.
Now I can catch on to some things, but most of that stuff is still just going to go straight over my head.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Because, mm-hmm. again, I grew up Catholic in the Bible Belt, which is kind of like growing up as somebody who speaks like Flemish in France. So you have like two different sets of cultural codes and signals going on. But I think what I liked about this book a lot, though, because there were, you know, some very clear plot lines that get set up, is I like that big things happen. Like, I like that at the end of it, Felice is driven insane and she's furious. And so she turns to Stein, who knows his geology, and she's like, all right, you know what? I'm going to fill the Mediterranean Sea a few hundred years early. So tell me what I need to break to get that water in. Mm-hmm. And then she does it. And that sweeps a lot of people off the board and sets up the next two books with the repercussions. I love that. I love that that happened. I love that Aiken becomes a power player over the course of the book. And I really like seeing more of the Tanu court intrigue, because you know that's going to keep going on. And my complaint about middle parts of series sometimes is once the world building has stopped and the machinations have to get in place, sometimes those books can be slow because you're setting up all the pieces on the board for like your final dramatic showdown. That's not the case here. Like there's just a lot that happens all of the time, constantly in this book.
And I feel like structurally she did, you know, besides the fact that the three parts seemed sort of random to me. But I thought that her structuring in terms of the way that the chapters spun out actually worked really well, because, you know, she didn't do the thing that I've noticed a lot of books have done in the past, like 10, 15 years, where you have like, here's your point of view character for this chapter. Now, chapter two is going to be a different point of view character. And we had a little bit of that in the first book. She doesn't do that here. She basically is just sort of moving from plot line to plot line, and sometimes location to location. But it's not always, you're not always getting it through the view of one particular character. So I just felt like I was constantly being moved along. And I felt like it wasn't like each chapter had a cliffhanger at the end of it, which is another thing that sometimes kind of gets on my nerves in books these days too. Is like, you know, so here's character number one and here's their chapter and here's a cliffhanger at the end of it. And then here's chapter number two and it's totally different. This wasn't that. This was each chapter actually felt like a nourishing meal. Like I had what I needed out of that little section and it added some information, even when it was something where a chapter where not a whole lot was happening. Like maybe you'd get one of the ones where you have Nonce Vell's host just like talking amongst themselves about humans and strategizing and that sort of thing. Nothing's actually like moving. We haven't moved any of the chess pieces, but we sort of understand a little bit better where each of these characters is coming from and what are the possibilities that they can do in their machinations, you know, in the High Council. And we get to the end of that chapter. And yeah, it was just 3 pages of people talking to each other about stuff, but it all worked really well for me. I enjoyed learning, you know, how they're looking at things.
She knows how to end a chapter.
Yeah.
Like in a really satisfying way where you close it and you're like, and she does it in the best possible way where it's really satisfying. And either it's a payoff that was set up from an earlier chapter and you're like, oh, or, there's a little bit of, oh, clearly something's going to happen next. And then you have to wait 2 or 3 chapters to figure out what it is.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the other chapters, you know, in the middle there will also give you some more sort of clues if you're looking closely enough as to where that particular plot line is headed. But yeah, you don't actually get it and the payoff until several chapters down the road. And yeah.
Oh, no, I love how she structures her chapters and the fact that occasionally be like, I don't want to know about this right now. I want to find out what's happening with so-and-so. That's that means that I'm into it and I can't bear the tension. And that it's nice to fall into a story like that. It really is.
Yes. Yeah, that was, you know, I felt like, and maybe at the very outset of this podcast, I was saying how I kind of got better with the book and the, you know, the 2019 brain reading this book from 1982, that frisson sort of settled down a little bit later on in the book. And I think that may just be because that was well after we got through the sections that to me were the most egregious. The really awful stuff sort of happens at the beginning. And then once you get into part two, it's well, except for the part where Suki is basically raped by the king.
Yeah.
That part. Yeah. And I do appreciate that she didn't actually linger on the sexual assault part of it. It was like, no. we didn't actually see that scene in the king's bedroom, which was nice. It was just sort of referred to. Like, that's like.
And I appreciate that because I can't tell you, I've lost track of how many times I've read a book and then one of the characters does get raped and it's described in detail. And you're like, really? Really? Mm-hmm. It's really. Why?
Yes, I hate it with a passion. Yeah. So I was glad not to have to live through that. However, we did get a pretty visceral description of Felice being violated, you know, mentally and emotionally, and it's implied that she's also been violated physically multiple times. But
it's implied that she's just that he just It's implied that there are no limits to what he will do. And it was a difficult passage to read. And the only thing I could really take out of it was that her mental control is formidable.
Yep.
And I think that's what you're supposed to take out of it. But I really wish there had been a way to to say that without describing some of the things they described.
Yep. Yeah, it was, you know? It was a little much.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was a lot less than in some other books that I have read, so I mean, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you're like, "Oh, good." And I do appreciate some of the comedy that she put into it. You know, the geneticist Lord Greg Donnett, who was clearly madder than a hatter.
Except was he?
I just really appreciate the way he behaves and the things he says, and it adds a bit of impishness to chapters that would otherwise be extremely portentous and insufferable.
And, you know, even the Aiken chapters, too, a good a good number of them have some pretty snappy dialogue between him and whomever he is either challenging or bantering with. I appreciated that because there are a lot of places where it's either just intense and because there's a lot happening or people are just hurt or angry or like Elizabeth. When we were talking about Elizabeth in the previous book, and actually in our very first episode, we were kind of thinking about what we remembered. I had remembered quite liking Elizabeth, and throughout the first book, like I felt like, yeah, she's cool, I like her. And now I get to this book, and now I kind of go, oh, that's what Lisa was talking about. Like as a child, I remember now sort of reading this bit of it, and she's just mopey. She's mopey as can be, and I can't blame her. Like I can look at that and I can understand. Okay, she came here to try to get away from everything, and now all she has is basically this, like you said, funhouse mirror. This is a funhouse mirror version of the actual Unity that she has experienced in the past, and she's stuck with it, and she doesn't want to be. She just wants to get up and go away, and you know I can't blame her for that, but it did feel felt mopey.
I was thinking that for the same way that I've complained that Mercy Rosmar gets a raw deal from the writer, I think another raw deal, Elizabeth's grief is never really fully, like, you could go one of two directions where either this is a woman who is deeply, permanently traumatized, and so she doesn't have the tools to deal with her trauma and she's trying to anyway. Like you could tell that story and make that apparent, or you can make it the story of this is a woman who has maladapted to her trauma and now revels in the identity of a victim, and her narrative development over the course of four books is going to be learning to let go of the pleasure that she takes in being a victim and recreate her identity as somebody else. And the thing is Elizabeth doesn't get either one of those stories. It's this weird middle path instead, where she's cast as this wise metapsychic guru to a woman who is several thousand years older than she
is. She's 14,000 years old. That surprised me. I was like, wow, okay.
I kept thinking 14,000 years at the tattoo sounds exhausting.
Right.
But you know, she's cast in some respects as the only sane adult in the place, and then she's cast in other respects as this as selfish and self-indulgent. And it's not that selfishness is not adequately explained or supported in this book. Like, it doesn't spring from the fact that she enjoys feeling like a victim or gets a sense of identity of being a victim. It doesn't spring from her grief. It's just implied that she's kind of a self-involved mope. And so it's tough to get a sympathetic read on her, and I think that's the fault of the writer. I don't think it's me failing to pick up what the writer is putting down.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Definitely.
The same way that I think the Amory and Felice thing... I feel like, again, it seems like a really, like, it's the tragic queer love story where they're like, my God, I must love my God. No, it's not fair. And I'm like, you know, this lacks nuance. This is just Amory systematically rejecting somebody for a lot of different reasons and telling Felice that she's terrible and broken. And then she goes and gets tortured by somebody who enjoys telling her how terrible and broken she is. And, some characters, like, it's obvious that May likes Aiken Drum and is devoted to having a sympathize with him and root for his rehabilitation. And there are other characters where, like, she's really big on redemption arcs, but she doesn't extend the same compassion or understanding of the human condition to some of her other characters, I feel. And Felice and Mercy get the brunt of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's... Well, I was going to say it's the women that are treated so badly, but honestly, except for Aiken, like, it's not like the guys have a great great run of it either. So,
no, Stein is basically treated as a bundle of misfiring impulses, and
yep.
We've talked about poor idiot Brian.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, well, that is one thing to say for these books that were written in the, you know, 70s and 80s, that we have such a bonanza of female characters that you can have ones that are treated in, you know, multiple different ways and not be quite so cranky about it as perhaps if there was just like one lady.
The girl. Yep. Starring four dudes and the girl. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
Because that was actually, to bring this back to Anne McCaffrey, I guess take it full circle, is that was actually one of the things I had the hardest time with the Dragon Riders of Pern when I was little and still kind of do now, mm-hmm. is the fact that basically you had this giant military structure and one lady.
Yep.
And even as a kid, it never made sense. I was like, why can't girls ride more dragons?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, I was hungry for that. And then you're right. It is gratifying to see multiple female and male characters. It's disheartening from a 2019 mind to see such an unnuanced take on gender. Like, Meg gets a lot right and she gets a lot wrong.
Yep. Well, is there anything else you want to say before we go into our brief little spoiler space area and talk about the oncoming books?
No, I think I'm talked out on this one. How about you?
I think I'm good. All right. Well, then let's move on to some spoilers. Yeah, I have to say, I really remember almost nothing about what's coming in the next two books. I was realizing, I wonder if I reread the first two books of this series at some point, maybe more than once, and then just for whatever reason, never got around to moving on to the other two books. So, like, I know that I have read them all, but I think I've read these first two books more times than the rest because, like, I have some of the very broad strokes. Like, I kind of know what happens, but specifically, I'm like, there's two whole books left. This little flippy thing in my head that I remember, like, there's two whole books left. Like, I found my brain kind of exploding a little bit when I got to the end of this one.
Oh, I think with the books that are coming up too, I had forgotten how much more complicated everything gets when you throw in the metapsychic rebels.
Yeah.
Because instead of just having to keep track of like six factions like we do in the first two books, mm-hmm. then you've got like three more factions of metapsychic rebels and you need a scorecard after a while. And I found myself dilemma. Okay, wait, who died? Oh, okay. Who's the, mm-hmm. But I am looking forward to the ascendancy of Aiken Drum. I'm looking forward to that a whole lot. And I am also looking forward to seeing Culliket get his own.
Yeah, I only have vague memories of that, but like I know, like, as the horribleness was happening, I was like, in the back of my head, I was like, he gets his. Like, I know it happens eventually. I don't remember exactly how, but I felt a little better just knowing that was on the horizon.
Yeah, May is too intensely moral a writer to let people get away with murder, mm-hmm. as it were.
Yeah.
Everybody gets a comeuppance because that has to serve her belief in a world where there is right and there is wrong, and wrong gets punished. Mm-hmm. But you know, still hard to read. So yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting the rebels again. And I'm looking forward to a more nuanced, like, I vaguely remember Mark from these books, like not a whole lot, but vaguely. And my impressions of him are more from how she wrote him in the later books, the ones that take place like Jack the Bodiless and Diamond Mask and all that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how he ends up post-rebellion and how that squares with the way she wrote him later.
Yeah, and I think my memories of him are mostly from these books, as fragile as they are. My memories are more from this, and I don't really remember him so much from the later books. So it'll be interesting to see if the picture that I have in my mind is even remotely close to what is happening here.
I mean, it could be like a Darth Vader thing where he's really awesome for three books, and then you get back to the origin story, you're like, oh, this is disappointing.
Yeah. Entirely possible.
I hope not. No, I oh my gosh. Yeah, the books really pick up at the end of this. The other group I'm looking forward to, because again, you have to keep track of God knows how many characters, mm-hmm. with these books, is I love Basil's Bastards.
They are
the ones who do the mountaineering, mm-hmm. and end up end up working closely with all sorts of other folk, and the cast of characters she assembles into Basil's Bastards are just reliably hilarious. So I'm looking forward to them again.
Now tell me, and you can spoil me because we're in spoiler space, but I was a little disappointed by how little we got of the Fervalag in this book. Do we get more of them in the next book or two?
Yeah, because they do some power manipulation. They do try to get to politics, and this is the book where you meet Catelyn Aldarkeye, right?
Yes, we met her here.
So you find out she goes to she marries a howler.
Yep. Yes, that happened in this one.
Yeah, and so the howlers get put on the playing field in the next two books.
Excellent.
Too.
Okay, I had totally forgotten that, but I was hoping just based on her little bit of the plot line there that would be a thing.
Yeah. No, it occurred to me while I was reading these books. This may be me taking a long way around to get the point. So when my niece was taking AP European History, like, she was just dying of boredom during the Tudor period. Like, she couldn't understand Henry VIII and why it was a big deal when he split from the church and what was going on. And I was like, okay, think of it as a soap opera and, like, sketch up who all your players were and who their alliances were to and who wanted money and who wanted power and this and that, and basically turned it to a big lurid retelling. And that's how she got through that unit. And I thought to myself, like, with this whole book of four, I was like, I wish I knew more about 19th century leading into the 20th century European history, because this honestly has the feel of like World War I, where you have empires breaking up and new alliances forming and modernity going up against old fashioned mores. And I thought to myself, this might be a really effective way to teach people about world history if you could just like map different factions to different countries somehow. It's just that complicated. We're like, wait, Serbia, what now? Who shot who? Where? Why? it's just a bananas level of complexity, but it rewards rereading, I think.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, despite how complex it is, I don't feel like it's overwhelmingly confusing the way sometimes sprawling epics get. Like, there's just too many characters and I can't keep it straight. Or maybe it's just the way that she does it works for my brain or something. But while I would occasionally like forget who was who and get the Tanu names mixed up a little bit, yeah. I could still keep track of the factions themselves and who they were. So we'll
see if track of who changes. Has what colors, because all
yeah,
the different
can't like, keep the colors straight. Nope.
Nope. And I feel bad because I know she put a lot of thought into it, and the pictures in her head are like, and this person's swanning around in pink glass armor, and this person's swanning around in purple glass armor. And I'm like, they're all just kind of...
Yep. And some of them are blue, but some of them are turquoise. It's important to get the shades correct.
I guess so. I mean, she also like specifies rosy gold and rose gold several times. And I'm like, oh, how millennial.
I wonder if she was even thinking of exactly the same thing that we think of now.
I don't think so. I was like, it's maybe not. Like a more yellow skewing pink. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But we'll have to polish our glass armor for the next one and see.
I think so. All right. Well, this was a delightful conversation about it. Boy, I had some feelings.
Oh, God. Well, I think we've worked through our feelings.
We did. Yeah, I definitely feel like catharsis right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's happened. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. I hope you will join us next time for The Nonborn King. I think it's The Adversary after that.
Yes, because that's the one with the really... My copy has this really trippy version of a 1970s hair wearing Mark Remillard on it, and it's delightful.
Awesome.
Yeah, he's got like the Greg Brady on the late years of the Brady Bunch. Yeah, that's great.
Right, so yeah, Volume 3, The Nonborn King. I'm sure we will have lots and lots to say about that, and we will see you next time. Until then, I have been Erica Ensign,
and I was Lisa Schmeiser,
and thank you once again for joining us on this epic journey. Saga of Rereading Epics is a proud part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. Visit theincomparable.com for more geeky podcasts, and while you're there, you can become a member, support the show, and get future episodes of this podcast right now.